Photography. Exploration. Filmmaking. Conservation. Wildlife. Take a deep breath. You're in the Hydrophone with Jorge Cervera Hauser.
Never want to sit still, Kinga Phillips has tested herself for the past 19 years by traveling the globe, scuba diving, free diving, spearfishing, surfing, jumping out of airplanes, spelunking, and swimming with sharks. As a writer, producer, and on-camera journalist for networks such as CBS, NBC, ABC, USA, AMC, Travel Channel, Fox Sports, Universal Sports, Current TV, Sci-Fi, Epics, and National Geographic. Welcome to the Hydrophone, Kinga.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start from the beginning. You were born in Warsaw as Kinga Szpakiewicz. Did I get it right?
Very close. Yeah, Szpakiewicz.
Szpakiewicz, okay. And besides the fact that so many consonants can be a challenge for the Western civilization, how did you become Kinga Phillips?
So when I first came to Los Angeles and started working in the entertainment industry, the first agent that I ever had took one look at my name, Kinga Anna Szpakiewicz, and went, yeah, no. Like you can't use that. No one's gonna hire you and no one will be able to pronounce that. It's just too much of a mess, find something else. So I went through phone books, I did all this different stuff. And I grew up Catholic and Polish. And I looked in the Bible and under Philippians 4:13, there was a verse and it said, I have learned the secret to be content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And I thought, wow, if that is not the perfect verse for the entertainment industry where you are living in plenty, living in want, have everything, have nothing, have lots of work, have no work. I thought, okay, that's perfect. So I took Phillips and I cut it, which is why it's spelled with one L and two P's, thereby putting myself in like a whole other category of trouble because it's spelled so unconventionally that most emails never make it to me because people do two L's and one P. So whenever I give my email, I have to in parentheses put one L, two P's.
Been like, there, done that.
Yeah. That's why I went to check. I was like, when you email me, let me know.
When and how did you get to the US? And why?
So we came in 1981, and my dad was part of the Solidarity Movement with Lech Wałęsa, which is the anti-communist movement in Poland. And it was a series of protests that went for 9 years, peaceful protests. And it was basically blue collar workers and the people of Poland opposing the communist regime. And my dad at the time, he's retired now, but he was a geologist that specialized in groundwater and oil. So he was actually coming to the United States and going to Oklahoma to co-work with a company there that did oil and groundwater research. And when he was there, he got to know these really affluent families and they would ask him about what his life like was in Poland because he was a curiosity. And my dad was like, well, I have a daughter and I have a wife and you know, you're given pieces of paper that tell you how much food you can have. And then you go stand in line. And by the time you get to the front of the line, it's gone. And they went, oh my gosh, that's insane. Like we can't allow this. Like, how do we change this? And he said, well, you can't because they're not letting entire families out of Poland. And that family that he was speaking to were very affluent in Oklahoma, a lot of cattle money, oil money, and they supported Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma, a Republican senator, and donated a lot to his campaign. And they asked on our behalf that he write a letter. And so we came out of Poland as a family based on this letter that he wrote. And then my dad was sitting in his office one day, and I believe it was an FBI agent who came in and wanted to talk to my dad and offered us political asylum. And we said no, because we were afraid that the government there would come after our family. So we became US citizens underneath basically, you know, the normal way. And since I was under 18, I just became a citizen through my parents. So I carry two passports. I have a US passport and I have a Polish European Union passport.
And you were what, like two at the time?
Five years old.
Well, I met you thanks to Sharks and the Ocean, but you have done so much more. From serious investigation journalism, hardcore adventure TV shows, to travel and lifestyle, and everything in between. You are probably one of the most versatile people I know.
You know a lot of versatile people.
Yeah, I know a lot, but you're like, really, you've done it all. And what are your favorite projects to work on and why?
Well, I believe that that versatility is called being a jack of all trades, a master of none. When I went to college, I had 7 different majors and I couldn't decide what I wanted to do because I realized I didn't want to do one thing for the rest of my life. And then journalism started to feel like a really good fit because I thought, wow, I can tell everyone else's stories and get to kind of experience it through them. So I did journalism and then I had an emphasis in anthropology as well in school. And I always had a passion for nature and the ocean. And then when I moved to California in like 2000 and getting to be near it on a regular basis, it just became, you know, my greatest passion. Surfing, diving, anytime I had downtime, I would spend on the beach and in the ocean. So the marine conservation side of it really came out of that passion and then getting to know people like Stephanie Brendel from Shark Allies. And, you know, then revolving in that circle, you get to know all kinds of amazing people, you and the, everyone that goes out to Guadalupe and the shark researchers and the scientists and the conservationists. And it's such an awesome world. And that has always been a passion of mine to bring that into the TV side of things. And it was always adventure and travel that I wanted to do. But for a long time, being a woman, that wasn't really available. And it was always like, you get to be the sidekick. Like you stand over there and point at things and let the guy say stuff. And it took a long time to actually get to the point where it became equal in the TV shows that you were partners and you were co-hosts and you guys both, you know, had the role of going out and being adventurous and being smart and really getting to put forward your best foot. And now, you know, that's changed and there are a lot of women in that space and I'm really grateful for it.
No, and I give a lot of credit to you to be able to pave your own way and get there. Because you've obviously positioned yourself like really well in that niche.
Well, thank you. But I'm a big believer that if you have a passion for something, you're going to be good at it. I would not be good if someone said, Kinga, we have this show about politics. And that's been brought to me. Shows about politics, shows about real estate. I would be the worst host ever because I'd have no passion for that. So for me, as an integrity of my career and being a good representative of what I'm doing and, you know, being a person who is respecting their bosses, I will only focus on projects that I'm passionate about. And those are very much in the travel, adventure, and ocean space. So I had to pave that way because it was either do that or leave and go do something else because I didn't want to do red carpet shows and I didn't want to do an E! Entertainment television show about celebrities. I mean, that's not knocking it. There are people who love that stuff and it's great. It's just not for me. So I wasn't going to do it.
So probably my personal favorite is Lost in the Wild, a fairly recent project when you and your co-host JJ Kelly followed the steps of people that disappeared while exploring the outdoors, right? And actually this morning in preparation for our podcast, I watched the one in Mount Nyangani in Zimbabwe. And I really loved it. For that show, what was the most bizarre disappearance you guys investigated and why?
You know, that show in the 20 years I've been doing this and I've had the opportunity to do some great shows with great people. I have to say Lost in the Wild is my favorite also, probably because it hits so close to home for me. Because we're talking, the premise of the show is basically we are like a true crime podcast come to life with a boots on the ground element of us actually going to the final locations where these people vanished, usually in very wild and exotic destinations, and following in their footsteps to kind of try to reveal what happened and then putting it all out into the audience so that maybe someone out there knows what the final puzzle piece is. And it hits close to home because I have traveled the world by myself. I have shown up to Mexico, Alaska, all over the United States, camping alone. Or, you know, I'll go with my sister or with one of my best girlfriends. So a lot of those stories were very personal to me because there was really no difference. And to JJ as well, because he's a big outdoorsman, there was really no difference between those people and us other than how it ended and the fact that we didn't disappear in Alaska or, you know, some place. And these people did. And the really cool thing about the show is that every one of those disappearances was completely different. And every one of them had different elements that really just spun you out, you know? And then you started to kind of, in some of the areas, you really started to cross over into the local folklore and mythology and legends that really impacted how people saw the disappearance, especially the one in Zimbabwe. You know, they call that the mountain that swallows people. There are stories that go back, I mean, nearly a century of people vanishing on that mountain and having like really crazy experiences. And as a journalist, when you're investigating a disappearance, you have to kind of sort through that and decide what elements of that actually are crucial to the story and which are actually hindering the story. Because sometimes people go, well, the mountain got him, nothing we can do. And then they leave. And we saw that in a couple of different situations. And then there are instances, you know, some of our stories, the one that was probably the scariest to me was the one in Panama about the two girls, because that was the one story that I can say those girls did nothing wrong. They did everything according to the book. You know, they left on a very well-trafficked hike in the middle of the day, and then they just vanished. And then all the crazy stuff with their phones and the pictures. And that one really, really sat with me because I have done so many hikes by myself. I have done so many hikes with just a friend, you know, backpacking or just day hikes. You know, what's the difference between those girls and me? I got lucky. They didn't.
And give us more context. What happened with them? How they disappeared?
This story, the Panama story with Lizanne and Chris, is probably our most famous story. And it's famous or infamous, as you can say, because it has so many conspiracy theories. So in Panama, in Boquete, these two girls came in, they were Dutch, and they were coming in to teach English in one of the schools there. And when they got there, they were told, oh, we're not ready for you. We won't be ready for you for a week. So they were like, oh, well, great. We have a week to hang out. So they were staying in like a homestay, and then they decided to go do this hike at the Pianista Trail. And they went and did the hike. We showed up, we did the hike, followed in their footsteps. It is an incredibly clearly marked trail. And for anyone who can put one foot in front of the other, it's not a very difficult trail. And then you get to the Continental Divide, and you can either choose to keep going, which is not advised because it can get a little sketchy, or you turn around. And the girls vanished. I believe they started this hike at 11 a.m. By 1 p.m., they were to the top. Their camera was recovered later, so there are photos of them at the top there. And then the girls never came back. So I can't remember if it was that night or the next morning, the people at their homestay alerted authorities. There was a massive search. And then a few months later, a backpack turned up in a village called Alta Romero. And it had the girls' cell phones, cash, passports, cameras, everything. All of this was turned over to the authorities and it was analyzed. And from their cell phones, they determined that for about 7 days after the girls disappeared, they had been trying to call the Panamanian equivalent of 911. And then the camera also had a bunch of photos that they had the photos of the girls going up the hike. So you kind of understood the progression of where they went. And then all of a sudden the camera just started black photos and photos of backpacks. And you couldn't really make any heads or tails of what they were trying to take photos of. There was one photo number 509, that was deleted and missing from the camera. And so that is just the fodder of conspiracy theories about, you know, who this, that. And then the people of the village were asked to help look for the girls. So they actually walked up the river from where the backpack was found, and they found bones. They found a hip bone, a foot bone still in one of the shoes, and I believe one other bone. I believe there were three bones found, and they belonged to the girls. The crazy thing is that the Panamanian government sticks to the story that the girls had made it to this monkey bridge, this really loose bridge, tried to cross it, fell into the river, were killed, and swept away. All the experts that we spoke to basically said there's no way in hell the girls made it to that bridge, and photos indicate that they were actually going in the other direction. Additionally, every expert that we spoke to said that river is so tumultuous, it is impossible that their bones were just found together. Even if the two girls fell together, unless they were tied together, there's no way that their bones turned up together. So it all seems a little too convenient in how their remains were found. And to this day, no one knows what happened to those girls, whether they had been kidnapped, whether they fell and got hurt. But it's in my mind why the show is so great is because when you actually go to these areas and you follow in their footsteps, you start to understand what this person was thinking or feeling, or you see the terrain. In my mind, there's no place for those girls to fall and get hurt. And if they did, people went through with dogs, with helicopters, search parties. They brought in, you know, searchers and dogs from the Netherlands. There's no way that if they were just laying off the trail, no one would have found them.
And after doing the show, what do you guys think happened?
Well, I think that, so at the end of every show, the way the show is done is it's kind of like Unsolved Mysteries meets, you know, some kind of an adventure show. So we present all the facts of the case, we dig to hopefully bring up some more facts. We show people the area because I think it's so important. When you listen to a podcast, you kind of have to visualize everything yourself. But when we're showing you exactly what the trail looks like, it becomes a little bit more real and people kind of start to understand that. And, you know, then we always speak to everyone from search and rescue to the authorities if they choose to speak to us. Panamanian authorities did not. We'll speak to families if they choose to speak with us. We spoke to the forensic expert who asked to remain anonymous, and he had worked on the bones of the girls. His feeling is that they were actually harvested for organ trafficking, which is horrific and morbid and awful in every way, but it's as plausible a theory as anything else. That trail also goes from the Bocas del Toro to Boquete and is a known drug trafficking trail. So the likelihood of those girls encountering someone who had nefarious intentions is pretty high. You know, so I definitely think that there was foul play involved. I don't think they just fell somewhere and died.
If you guys are interested in watching Lost in the Wild, a bunch of the episodes are on YouTube, and I don't know where else can they watch it.
YouTube, Hulu, On Demand, and Amazon Prime.
Perfect. And besides doing adventure and TV shows, you love the ocean, you're involved in conservation. You just mentioned Shark Allies. I'm wearing my Shark Allies t-shirt today, which you gave me. I know nonprofits, and a lot of them are all talk and no results. That's not the case with Shark Allies. I vividly remember in 2010, when nobody was turning their heads to look at sharks, Shark Allies actually had a major hand in banning the possession, sale, and trade of shark fins in Hawaii, which I believe it was the first state of the United States to ban shark fins. That's a great accomplishment. It set the basis and the foundations for more states to follow on the same footsteps. What is Shark Allies doing today? What are you guys working on today?
Well, so that's a great point you bring up. And that's actually one of the things that I'm most proud of being a part of Shark Allies, is that we are a very small, very scrappy organization. And you're right that there are a lot of organizations out there. And look, I think a lot of people mean really well, but, and you and I have had our personal conversations about different people in the conservation space and who is actually doing something that is concerning the ocean and animals at hand, and who is actually just taking pretty photos and calling that conservation. To each their own. What you speak of in 2010 was all Stephanie Brendel. And that was before my time with Shark Allies, but that is actually how I got to know who she was. And Stephanie in 2010 pounded the pavement. She wasn't posting photos of herself in a bikini swimming with sharks on Instagram and calling it conservation. You know, she was not on Instagram posting photos screaming about why, stop killing sharks. That's all great. I call that activism or Instagram modeling, however you want to look at it. What she was doing is she was too busy to be posting any photos because she was pounding the pavement of legislation and actually affecting change in the best way possible. And you're right, Hawaii was the first state in 2010 to ban the sale, trade, and possession of shark fins. And that was not, you know, the end of the battle. They've had a battle repeatedly for other aspects of that. And then that snowballed, and there have been multiple states in the United States that have affected such change. And right now, Stephanie and Laurel, who are just the biggest badasses in the whole wide world, and a lot of our Shark Ally supporters, have been pounding that same pavement in Florida to enact that kind of legislation, which would then ban the sale and trade of shark fins. Because basically, even though we are not a society that consumes shark fin soup, which is basically the one of the greatest threats to sharks. About 100 million of them are killed every year for shark fin soup. We are a facilitator, because even though the act of finning, which is cutting off a shark's fin and throwing the live animal back into the ocean to drown, is illegal in our waters, that does not mean that those fins that have been illegally harvested do not come through our ports. And that's our responsibility to shut that down. And right now, Florida is the biggest port where shark fins come in and then make their way over to Asia. So our goal is to, look, we got to shut that down on our own turf before we can start moving forward and enacting change in other parts of the world.
Is there anything that people listening can do to actually help push this through?
Absolutely. You know, our voices are really, really important. And if you go to Shark Allies, the website, and you take a look, there are letters that you can just write to your local representative. There are letters that you can write to Florida representatives. There are petitions that you can sign. All of that matters. All of it matters. Like, people's voices being heard is incredibly important, because as legislators make a decision whether to put something into law, they're going to consider both sides. And one of the things that we have really been focusing on with Shark Allies, and we were just having a conversation about it too, is, you know, the Worth More Alive campaign. And as a lot of fishermen will argue that we're taking money out of their pockets and they have the right to land sharks, cut off their fins and sell them. And Jorge, I have to tell you, the loopholes are absolutely unbelievable. You start to realize how like insane people are with trying to get to loopholes. There have been instances of fishermen landing a shark and then say the law is that you have to land a shark whole. You can't cut off. You can't bring in, I think the wording was like, you can't bring in a shark without fins attached. So what they did was they cut off the shark's big fins, took another shark's small fin and sewed it on. And we're like, well, it's attached. The law says that you need fins attached. So basically humans are assholes is what we've come to find. But there are also a lot of really amazing humans. And so this new campaign, basically Worth More Alive, which you see every day in your business, is the idea that people going out into nature and ecotourism and getting in the water with sharks and seeing them can bring in so much more money for a community than killing a shark once and selling its fins. You know, Cabo Pulmo is a perfect example of that, isn't it? You know,
that's the best example of people turning it around and making more money out of protecting something rather than killing it.
I mean, what, Cabo Pulmo has one dirt street and what, five dive shops on that street? I think there are four or five there. What would that community, why would people show up to that community other than to get in the water in Cabo Pulmo National Reserve there, preserve, and swim with the bull sharks and the jacks, and you see those beautiful photos posted by National Geographic, all the free divers, all the scuba divers of their interactions with sharks. That community is making so much money on that reef, which is, by the way, one of the oldest reefs in North America. It's incredible. It's like 20,000 years old, I think.
Yeah, it's probably the oldest and the one farthest north on the Western Pacific.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Cabo Pulmo is that it was the local community that made it all happen. They used to be a fisherman by trade for generations, and then suddenly they realized that one resource they were depending on to make a living, it was fading away. They were overfishing so much that it was disappearing.
Yeah.
And it was out of their own initiative that they decided to, instead of keep on fishing, they turned into snorkeling and scuba diving. And it was mainly the Castro family, which is one of the oldest families in Cabo Pulmo.
And one of the dive shops.
And they were, and they were the ones to go to the government and to push legislation. And they are the front line defending Cabo Pulmo in the last two governments, which is the last 12 years or 14 years. There were two mega tourism projects that were to be built by Cabo Pulmo, and they were stopped twice. And they were like this major, major Chinese funded resorts that would have killed the reef. And And thanks to the Castro family and thanks to people like Sylvia Earle that has been so much involved in the conservation of Pulmo, I think it's probably the best example of local communities taking care of their own resources. In the last 15 years, the biomass of Cabo Pulmo has increased by 500% or more.
500%, yeah. And I think that's the key. You know, you can't affect that kind of change without the local community. And you also can't, we've learned in conversation and conservation, you cannot be the people who walk in to a community that is not your own and go, we're here to rescue you. You're doing something bad. Stop doing that. You're horrible people. You can't. You have to get into the mindset of people. If you tell a fisherman in Mexico or in Indonesia or in Fiji, oh, you know what? I don't want you feeding your family because you shouldn't be killing these animals. No, you can't do that. That's ignorance. You can't do that to someone. You have to give someone an alternative. And if the community chooses to do that alternative on their own, that's even better.
And speaking of, let's call it fake conservation and laptop activists, there is something people like us, and by us, I mean Kinga and Jorge, will always be largely judged by, and that is the fact that we are not vegan or vegetarian. I know for a fact that you and I share the same views on being aware of where our food comes from and in consequence, being responsible about what we eat and how we source it. You love spearfishing and you're also a big fan of the eat what you catch philosophy. Tell me more about how did you get into spearfishing and why it can even be more sustainable and responsible than many vegan options out there.
This is such a hot topic, and I'm happy to speak to it. So how I got involved in all of this is I started free diving basically because of Travel Channel, because they were really lovely and thought I was way better at things than I actually was. So they were like, oh, you know, you've been in the water free diving once or twice. So here we go. We're going to put you in the water with Sean Harada, who's an amazing spear fisherman in like 100-foot deep water in Hawaii. Go ahead. You got this. And I was like, what? And sweet Sean Harada, who I credit with basically introducing me to free diving, was like, take your snorkel out of your mouth and helped me figure it out. And I loved it so much. I went, I got to learn more about this. So I came back, took a class, started free diving regularly. And then when I met Mark, my boyfriend, he was, and I spearfished that time in Hawaii. Didn't catch a thing. Basically, we're just ridiculous yard sale. Couldn't figure it out. Of course, Sean got multiple fish and then shared them with me for dinner that night. He's such a lovely human. And I developed such a passion for it. And then when I met Mark, he was already also a trained free diver and he had gotten into spearfishing. And our philosophies were very much the same. We love wildlife. We love animals. We love conservation. I'm not a vegan, I'm not a vegetarian. That is a purely a by choice thing. I do not believe in shaming anyone for being vegan or not being vegan. I also believe that when you argue something, you do need to research your facts and you need to have some logic behind it. I do not believe that this world would be a better place or remotely sustainable if everyone was vegan. That's just, I can give you statistics and numbers on what it would take to basically turn the entire world into a plant-based, plant-fueled world, and it just doesn't work.
There are major studies on it, actually.
There are major studies, but yeah, very many, actually. I also think that everyone's system is different. I have tried to eat vegan and vegetarian. It does not work for my system, and that's okay. What I do believe is super important is that human beings as a whole, because we are mostly urban dwellers, have lost our relationship to nature in many ways, whether it's like we talked about earlier, whether being prepared or understanding nature when you go out into the outdoors, but also our connection to food. Most children, if you take them now and you bring them into a grocery store, that's where they think meat comes from or fish come from. A lot of that meat is mislabeled, especially when it comes to fish. We know that with Shark Allies that a lot of white fish is sold as white fish. It's in fact shark. Flake in the UK is shark. You don't know what you're buying. You don't know where you're eating, what you're eating. You don't know how it was raised. You don't know how it lived. And I do believe that animals deserve to be treated well. I don't believe in, you know, cows being munched together, chickens, pigs, in filth and then slaughter. It's not healthy for them, it's not healthy for us, it's just not how it should work. When it comes to spearfishing or hunting, if you eat what you take. If you're a huntitarian, I do not have a problem remotely with that. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to spearfishing, because Mark and I are both environmentally conscious, we go, we dive the reefs, we see the environment, we know when certain fish are in season, we know when to leave them alone when they're spawning. And even for the people, you know, we understand obviously that not everyone is gonna buy a spear gun and go start spearfishing their own fish or hunting for their own meat. I completely understand that. But with that kind of thinking, you can put that into your own life by saying, I'm gonna choose to source my meat differently. I wanna go buy it directly from the farmers. I want to understand where my food comes from. Even if that's the only takeaway you have, if you're not, you know, getting your own fish, but you want to understand where your food comes from, that's already better than just blindly going in and buying whatever Ralph's has to offer that day.
Definitely. And I think the two keys are consuming locally and knowing the source. And if you know the source, you can always, if you live by the coast, you can link up to local fishermen, to artisanal fishermen, you can link up to farmers and be more conscious, just more conscious about where your food comes from. And the world would be a better place if everybody did that. And speaking of outdoor activities, I like to think of myself as somebody that does a little of everything without knowing much of anything. For example, I freedive, but I'm far from being the best freediver. And same with spearfishing, skydiving, motorcycles, boating, flying planes, even riding. And that's another thing where I can really identify with you. And I wanted to ask you, if you had to be stuck with only one outdoor activity, what would you choose and why?
Oh my gosh, Jorge, that is such a difficult question for the reason you just listed. That is really hard. It would be such a toss up between free diving and surfing. It really would be. But I have to say that ultimately free diving would probably win out because I love so much the experience of being on the water. Like to me, that is the ultimate example of being present because you have no choice. And I think quite frankly, across the board, that's what nature forces us to do. You know, we live in a society where we're bombarded, constantly stimulated. I have a brain like a squirrel. I'm constantly looking around. I can't keep my attention on anything. But when you are freediving and you're on your own breath, it becomes imperative for a survival purpose that you are aware of your surroundings, of your body, that you know what you're doing, you know where you are, you know how your body's feeling, how it's responding. It's one of the only times that my brain slows down and I can focus on the magic around me and just be super present.
I never thought of it that way. And I think you couldn't be more right. It forces you to be present. And I also like the fact that it's like going back to the origins. Yeah. I'm a science guy, and I do think we come from this tiny fish that developed limbs and decided to walk out of the ocean one day. And actually, there's this thing when you free dive, there's the marine mammal
reflex,
which is when your body genetically remembers what it's like to be underwater, and it just comes by naturally. And I think that's great. And it's an amazing reminder of how complex and how amazing our body is. And that's also one thing I love about free diving.
Absolutely. And it's, to me, one of the most incredible things about free diving is when you say to someone, we went to Catalina over Memorial Day weekend and we brought our friend Barbara. And we were talking about free diving and she got so excited, got in the water. She had done a little bit before. She's now taking a class and doing free diving level one, but she was asking about the class. And I said, okay, well, the requirements are for free diving level one, you have to hold your breath static for 3 minutes. You got to go down to, I think it's 66 feet. We went to, I think 72 when we did it just because of the area we were in. And she was like, well, what? I can't do 3 minutes. And I was like, you know, what's really interesting is I'm a very competitive person. And because I've had to be by nature of what I do for a living. And when I took the free diving class, it was myself, my best friend who is a surfer, he's a man. And then there was another guy in the class who is a big wave rider. And his purpose for taking the class was he wanted to understand that his body can be comfortable underwater when he gets pinned under like a 30-foot wave. And I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to hold my breath for 3 minutes tomorrow. And I was having such a panic attack because I thought I'm going to be the only one who can't do it. These guys have bigger lungs. They can do it. And I was blown away how the body adapted. And I held my breath like this for 3 minutes, could have gone longer. Static, obviously you and I know what that means, but to everyone else, it just means your body isn't actively moving. So you have your hands on the side of the pool and your face in the water. Your active breath hold is usually half of that, if not a little bit less. But then going down to, you know, the 70, I think it was 72 feet when we did it, because it was off of Casino Point Catalina, right by the where the buoys are. And I remember looking up when I hit the bottom and I grabbed some sand just to prove I had made it down and then put it up on the board. And I remember looking up and seeing that column of water above me and thinking, holy crap, I'm down here on my own breath. This is amazing. And that feeling to me is just the fact that the human body with really 2 weekends worth of training can do that is incredible.
There's a very corny opening line for a movie, a surfing movie called Chasing Mavericks. And it's super corny, but I really like it. And it goes something along the lines that we all come from the sea, but we are not all of the sea. And those of us who are drawn to come back over and over. And I think that's exactly how you feel after you've experienced free diving and you've been out there, and That describes exactly that feeling, I think.
It also describes the feeling of the conservation statement of you protect what you love. And to me, like people like you who has all these tourism businesses and takes people out, I admire that so much, because one of the only ways to get people passionate about the ocean, about sharks, about whales, you name it, is to get them in their presence. Because the moment someone has an experience with the sharks at Guadalupe, with the dolphins and the mantas at Socorro and the schooling sharks, it's incredible, incredible that place. But the moment you have that experience, you start to take personal ownership of it because you've had that experience. The same thing with the ocean. And when anything comes along that threatens that experience that you had and that love for that place, you become more defensive of it. It's no longer out of sight, out of mind, or, oh, I don't know what Socorro is. Someone's trying to, you know, fish there. Who cares? I don't know. When you've been there, you're like, what the hell, man? That's my place. You don't touch that. And that's the feeling that you want to instill in people, is you want them to personally take ownership of these natural resources, because that's what they are, aren't they? They're ours.
I get it a lot when people come and say, okay, you guys in the tourism or in the diving industry, you're all about the money. And you don't care about the animals. And that couldn't be farther away from the truth for many of us. And I mean, speaking for me personally, if I wanted to make money, I could be doing a lot of other different things and I would be making more money. Just the fact of bringing people closer to sharks or to these faraway marine environments, that makes a difference. And that's the major first step in order to change those mindsets and to make people aware of what's out there. And other than that, owning these businesses has put me in the board seats for national parks. It has put me in a position where I can donate to research, where I can donate to conservation, to scientists. And I think I've done much more through my companies than what I've done from nonprofits, and not trying to make it less in any way, because we've done some very interesting things like books and movies and fundraisers and whatnot. But through the companies, I've been able to achieve much more. And I woke up this morning to realize that the new government is cutting 75% of the funding for CONAMP, which is the national parks. And the boats working there are the only ones patrolling the area and giving money to the parks and to research.
You know, what you speak to is what we talk about all the time, and why we as Shark Allies have chosen to partner in many cases with these ecotourism boats and go out and give talks and support and help. And because we understand the value, like going out to Socorro on the Solmar a couple of years ago, when I went out with you guys, I remember the crew telling us how important it is that the boats are there, because 10 years before that, what you would find there are a bunch of fishing boats that were taking the sharks, that were taking all the big fish, that were just decimating the biomass. And now that's a humongous territory. And for even if the Mexican Navy is committed to patrolling it, how many boats do those people have? So when you have the tourist boats out there and they can radio in and say, hey, there's some suspicious activity over here, that is a benefit. And again, like those boats, the employees on their boats are making a paycheck on keeping that biomass healthy and sustainable for future generations. And it's the same thing with Guadalupe. You know, I've gotten I sometimes don't even want to engage anymore because ignorance is the bane of my existence. And I just expect people to have a little bit more intellect or do a little bit more research on their own. But so many people come to me and gone, oh, I hate that you got to Guadalupe because, you know, you're changing the behavior of sharks because, you know, sometimes they'll put a fish head in the water and sharks now associate boats with people. And I'm like, dude, that ship literally sailed about 2,000 years ago when people started putting boats in the water and scraps were being tossed off and sharks associated them with food. Like, you're not going to change that. It does not mean in any way that sharks are like, there are people on that boat. There was a fish head in the water. I need to attack people. It's just do your research. Like, do a little bit of study about sharks. Do a little bit of research about boats. Educate yourself before you come at. But we also live in a society where what people who are angry about a variety of things don't necessarily have a foundation for why they're angry. They're just angry and they want to lash out. When in reality, everyone that I've ever worked with in the ecotourism space is so unbelievably passionate and are doing so many wonderful things for conservation. They also have an eye on the prize, don't they? Like, you guys are in Guadalupe, you guys are on Socorro, you know what's going on. Like, you can tell that story. You can advise scientists on what you're seeing out there. It's if everyone just stayed away and backed off, I guarantee that the people who shouldn't be there would come in and would decimate those areas.
That's a fact. And I think as wonderful as the internet is, one of the bad things is that, okay, so a lot of people don't want to do research, and a lot of people that it's really easy to get inaccurate information to defend your wrong point of view. And it's super easy to connect with other stupid people. So it's a two-sided blade, I think.
Well, you have to, I don't know if you saw my series of rambling posts when I got super irritated about the conspiracy theories during COVID-19. And part of my argument was, not only should you do your research, but make sure that you're looking at the source. If your source, and I started tracking some, this is funny because I started tracking some of those conspiracy theories back, and they ended, would always end with some blogger in his mom's basement, like putting out a theory. And then there was no foundation for that whatsoever. So you have to be incredibly careful of what your source is, because you're right. And I started posting on my Instagram, I started posting stories about Bigfoot and the chupacabra and how birds are actually, you know, police, the government has created birds to watch us all and the earth is flat. And they were all stories basically saying this is real. And I was like, look, you know what my point is? You can find anything on the internet and you can support anything on the internet. Your job as an intelligent human being is to not only do your research, but also check your sources. As a journalist, it's personally offensive to me when I see people reposting crap that I'm like, you clearly did no research on this and you just reposted someone else's bullshit. And that's offensive and dangerous.
Going back to your work, you have a new TV show coming up. It's produced and hosted by Samuel L. Jackson called Enslaved. Yeah. It looks really, really interesting. And I think it's coming out this month.
It was going to come out this month.
Okay. So what is it about? When is it coming out? And when can people see it?
So Enslaved is a 6-part documentary series telling the story of the transatlantic slave trade through the lens of diving shipwrecks that were associated with the slave trade. So it's a lot of moving parts, and I am part of the journalistic dive team that had the phenomenal opportunity to go to some of these incredible locations around the world and dive these shipwrecks and bring those stories to life of the people who are aboard those ships. Then we have Sam Jackson, who is the main host of the show, who is following his own path to Africa, where his roots are, and having that experience and helping to tell the story. We have Afua Hirsch, who's an incredible journalist. She's helping to tell the story. We have Simca, who is our director, who I love so very much, who is also intermixed in the story. So we have all these different moving parts. But it is such a profound and incredible story to tell. I was so fortunate to get to be invited to be a part of it because I love diving. I love telling stories. I love opening people's eyes to that. And as far as when it comes out, it was originally supposed to come out on June 19th of this year. I don't think that is the case because, as a matter of fact, the date right now, I'm supposed to be in the Caribbean finishing up that shoot. But because of COVID, we aren't able to finish it. So we are hoping that we can do that in August. And then I'm thinking that the series will probably come out at the end of this year. But I'm really excited about it because the story of slavery is one that has been told many times, should continue to be told, obviously. But I think that every time you tell it from a different perspective and through a different lens, you reach a different audience. And this one is really well done because it is telling these very, very profound stories, but it all is also giving you this adventurous angle where you actually get to go down and see these wrecks. So it's going to be really powerful, and I'm super excited about it.
Perfect. I will definitely keep my eyes open for that one. And now to wrap it up, I like to finish these interviews with what I call the close encounter trifecta.
Ooh.
So you have to tell me, short and sweet, your most awesome, the scariest, and your most moving wildlife encounter. Awesome, scary, moving, go.
Awesome. You know that the first time I had ever been in the water with whales was this New Year on your boat off of Cabo? That is the first time I have ever been in the water with whales. And that to me was an unbelievable experience. Yeah, so that, what was next?
The scariest and the most moving encounter.
Gosh, it's so funny. Most of these are connected to you. So one of the scariest was off of the Solmar when we jumped in the water because the false killer whales were coming by and I didn't have my suit on. I didn't even have a snorkel. We were just jumping in. And the silky sharks that were on the reef, and they had been with us the whole time watching us at safety stops, and they're funny and you know, they're super curious, but they were now in predatory mode. And I wrote about this in the article. And at one point I was looking around and all of a sudden I turn and there's a silky shark like this. And I'm like, oh man. And I realized immediately it had nothing to do with the shark. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the shark started darting in and I was like, oh. So I start throwing punches at it because I'm thinking this is all I can do. You know, we're 18 hours away from an island that a plane can land. Like, it's not going to kill me, but it's going to damage me. And I remember one of the dive masters saw this happening and swam over as fast as he could and grabbed me, turned me away. And then Mauricio was on the boat. And I remember talking to him and talking about how the whites of our hands and the whites of our feet look like the inside flesh of a fish. And because this shark was in predatory mode following the false killer whales, thinking that it was going to get tuna scraps, I basically looked like a tuna scrap to it. So there's no, you know, no harm, no fault. I was in the wrong place. And the shark was like, tuna. Ah, wait, you're not tuna.
Polish tuna.
Polish tuna.
And the most moving encounter?
You know, I think some of the most moving encounters I've ever seen are off of Guadalupe, watching people get out of the shark cage. Obviously, seeing those sharks come by and look at every single diver in the eye, and they don't have this dead black eye, but they're actually rimmed in blue, and they're so beautiful. They come by, they look, they're very calm, and watching people get out of the shark cage and have come to God moments, they cry, they have to go take a moment and sit on the front of the boat because they have this realization that everything they've been told about sharks as bloodthirsty man killers has been basically a bullshit story, and that these animals are actually really incredible and beautiful and you can have a connection with them.
That's great. And I love how it had to do more with the people's reaction than an actual encounter. Love it. Well, you can find Kinga on Instagram as at Kinga Phillips, 1L2Ps, and myself as JC Hauser. Kinga, thank you for your time. It's always great to catch up.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of it.
Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast broadcaster. Thank you for listening. I really hope you have first seas during these strange pandemic times we're living in. See you next week.
This was The Hydrophone with Jorge Cervera Hauser.